Thank you all for coming to the War College. My name is Dana Lombardi. I'm saying all this because it's getting recorded and we'll get up on the website for people that want to hear it later or want to hear the talks that they weren't able to get to. The War College here at Celesticon has been on for several years. We have a variety of speakers talking on different subjects. This year in particular, because it's part of the centenary of World War I, we have quite a few talks about World War I, including Leland Erickson, who's been one of our speakers here and at other war colleges. He's going to be talking about French tanks in World War I. Because we read English, we usually get the British viewpoint on everything, including on the French. And we know about the British tanks and Cambrai and their operations. But as Leland will point out, there's a much closer connection between modern tanks and what the French invented than what the British did. And I'll let Leland explain that.
All righty. Thank you, Dan. Thank you all for coming. This talk is, as it says, L'Artillerie d'Assault, which is the later name chosen for France's Artillerie Spéciale. Their tank forces. They were originally, as the name implies, a derivative of the French artillery arm in the First World War. In 1916, everybody's got a problem. This is a typical French trench in the Western Front. As you can see, this is the battlefield, and it is a nightmare. They're not getting anywhere fast. Nobody is. You got our big guns, but as you can see, most of them move with horses and manpower. So pushing the guns forward to support an assault that actually manages to break through an enemy's trenches, well, the advance outpaces the guns and their support. And of course, it doesn't outpace the opposing side's guns, who turn the landscape into a lunar scape, as you can see in this photo from the battlefield around Verdun. 1916, the French and Germans had just completed one of the bloodiest battles of history, the epic siege of Verdun. The French and Germans between them sustained just horrendous casualties in the hundreds of thousands on both sides. The original plan the Germans had was to sucker the French in and, as Falkenhayn said, bleed them white. Instead, it backfired. The French resistance was more than they expected, and they got sucked in almost as badly as the French. This is the other problem. Everywhere you turn, barbed wire, and little or no means to cut it. You hit it with explosive artillery, it throws the wire in the air, and it comes back down. It's still there. The shrapnel rounds and such of the day, the means to cut wire just by explosive force, they hadn't come up yet. They hadn't got there yet. And the wire entanglements could be huge. Of course, this is the nemesis of the infantryman in the First World War, the machine gun. A well-entrenched machine gun, it was said, could hold off up to a division. It just had to be placed right. There's no other means to counter it except your rifles. And if you tried to bring up your big clunky machine guns, of course, you have to cross the no man's land to get in range and set up and try to return fire. Most likely, at that point, you have been hit yourself. So, there's nowhere to hide. These are Russian soldiers who died on the wire on the Eastern Front. As you can see, the infantryman, all he had to rely on was his rifle and hopefully not being one of those hit. It was a formula for stalemate. It just made... turned the Western Front into one long, continuous siege line. Nobody was getting anywhere fast. The artillery is predominantly horse-drawn. Operations proceed at the pace of a man on foot trying to cross no man's land. So, stalemate. Everybody kind of hunkers down. There are probes, there are raids, but nothing is really changing by 1916. That doesn't mean they're not trying. They're pushing both sides, or mainly the Allies, have a huge political incentive to push the Germans off French soil. So they continue to assault the German positions. And of course, they continue to lose. They cannot get the guns up to follow up and support an assault. They just don't have the technical means yet. Tactics have evolved from the beginning, as this montage someone put together on the internet This is from a book I have, an excellent photo book in a series that they're published in France. They use actual, authentic uniforms, vintage uniforms and equipment, and they have models or reenactors pose with this equipment and uniform gear and gear. And as you can see, starting on the left in 1914, the French soldiers went to war in a uniform not much different than that worn in 1870 in the Franco-Prussian War. There really isn't a lot of change. The rifle is better. It's a magazine-fed Lebel rifle, so it can sustain fire. But beyond that, they present a rather nice target. 1915. Well, the red trousers are gone. They were not a good idea. The dark blue overcoat didn't help much either, so they came up with Horizon Blue, which is actually a product of politics. It incorporates red, white, and blue fibers, believe it or not, because that red trousers, as one French pre-war politician declared, are France. So, in transition, this fellow here has an early primitive gas mask. It's basically a thick cotton pad soaked in chemicals to keep out the first poison gas. He's got goggles on. You can't quite see him here to protect his eyes. In his hand, he's holding a steel skull cap that slips under his kepi. This is the precursor to what comes by 1916, the Adrian helmet. And so now we have the full Horizon Blue uniform, the Adrian helmet, a better rifle called the Berthier, which has swapped out the tubular magazine for a box magazine. Gas mask is improved, but still he's weighed down with all this gear. Now imagine trying to slog your way through the mud and the water and the barbed wire of the Western Front, carrying about 80 pounds of gear and ammunition and weapon. Good luck to you. By 1917, they figured out to lighten the soldier's load, at least on the assault. So this is called assault order. As you can see, he's not carrying nearly as much gear. His gas mask is worn around his neck at the ready rather than in his storage can. And still, same problem. How is he going to get past all that mud and the barbed wire and that artillery fire and the machine guns? Well, this is part of the change. By 1916, French infantry squads are receiving these, one per squad. The 8mm CSRG 15, or shell shot automatic rifle, is a very primitive, crazy weapon. Going into its details is beyond the purview of this talk. However, it did earn the reputation, rightly or wrongly, as the worst machine gun ever designed. Germans are evolving their own tactics and weapons. They're trying to break the stalemate, too. This is an early German flamethrower, seen here in the immediate aftermath of the war, being used for riot control in Germany. I'm not joking. They use flamethrowers for riot control. That was the Freikorps' answer to rioting trade unionists or Bolsheviks. They broke out the flamethrowers, the Flammenwerfer. Well, by 1916, they've developed the flamethrower, and they introduced them at Verdun, where they were a rude surprise to both sides, because the French quickly figured out that if we shoot the dolt that is holding the hose, he drops the holes, and we can then either force the guy wearing the gas tank to surrender or just shoot him. So they actually captured several during the fighting for Fort Douaumont and turned them on the Germans in the next wave. But again, they're trying to break the stalemate. The Germans evolved the Stosstruppen, or stormtroopers. Infiltration tactics, they are the precursor to modern infantry assault tactics. You've got to give credit where credit is due. They had probably the most sophisticated infantry tactics of the war. So this is ostensibly a photo showing Stosstruppen on the assault. I would say it's not. I would say this is a training mission, but I could be wrong. Notice the Pickelhaupts. They've already got this. They have not introduced the Stahlhelm universally to all units. So the Pickelhaupts are still showing up as late as 1915, 1916. So they're trying to come up with solutions. The Allies, again, they have the pressure on. They've got to get the Germans off French soil. What do we do? What to do? How do we get across an infantryman across no man's land? Well, this was one proposed idea. And yes, one man would stick the front half of his entire body into this thing and push it along with his legs. He'd be laying prone in it. And the idea was he could push his way up to the wire under fire, and once upon reaching it with that hook at the front, get a hold of it and use it somehow to pull back. Well, obviously, it was a great idea to some, but for somebody on paper, it was never used for obvious reasons. So still, what to do, what to do? They come up with this crazy thing. It's like a gigantic, they called it the Diplodocus militare, literally military dinosaur. It's actually a moving frame with an engine in the middle, and it's like one giant track. And its whole idea was that it would literally crush the barbed wire. Of course, its vulnerability in trying to cross no man's land, where it could move across country at a rate slower than a walking man, was immediately obvious. But it began to cause some people to think. Namely, Colonel Jean-Baptiste Estienne. This is the father of the French tank arm. And he wanted to break the stalemate. And he was looking for technical solutions. And he looked at the Diplodocus militaire. And he was like, probably said something very French and very soldierly, which I won't repeat here, and decided there had to be a better way. And, of course, the French army were innovators. By the time of Verdun, they were increasingly moving their troops in trucks up to the front. In fact, it was the mass use of trucks at Verdun that was a critical, critical element of their success against the German assault, in that they kept a constant rotation of trucks bringing ammunition supplies into Verdun and removing wounded personnel, bringing in fresh troops, taking out exhausted ones. They kept that road going 24/7, and they began to use tractors to move their heavy guns. These fellows, this is probably taken around 1915, so they're getting serious. So Estienne is thinking, barbed wire breaker, tractor. Meanwhile, in England, along comes the idea for a landship. This is a Mark I male because it has cannons. The females have machine guns. This is what the British are up to, and the British were telling their friends, the French, what they were doing, as the French were telling the British what they were trying to come up with to bring down the wire. So this, we have a parallel evolution going on here, and the French are aware of what they're doing. So Estienne decides, if we, and his, some of his like-minded French engineers think, we take a whole tractor and we put an armored box on it, and we put a single 75mm howitzer in the front, and we can get a couple of machine guns and ball mounts on either side, we have an armored assault vehicle. And so this is France's first tank, the Char d'Assault Schneider, CA-1. As you can see, it's not much to it. It's a box on tracks. And it has this funny bow, boat-like prow, because they thought, they kind of hoped that it would help it when it tried to cross an allied obstacle. If the bow hit the opposite side of the shell hole or whatever it was crossing, that this pointed bow would help it force its way across, because the engines of the day aren't that powerful. But the French have a tank. Now, meanwhile, they're asking their friends, the British, please, please, wait for us to work the bugs out of our Schneiders so we can use tanks at the same time as you do, and we can have the element of surprise across the front and just really take the Germans off balance. Well, the British said, well, boy, that's a great idea. Yes, capital idea. We'll get back to you. So, meanwhile, the French keep trying to do their thing, and meanwhile, the British go ahead and use their tanks during the Somme, and out goes the element of surprise. The French aren't ready yet by 1916. This is an example of French innovation. This, not the tank, but the painting. The French were the first to invent pattern camouflage painting. A French academic artist, basically an art professor, who was serving in the French artillery in 1914 and 15, realized that the light gray color you see here used to paint French guns, well, it wasn't really working. the Germans kept spotting the darn guns and taking them under counter battery fire with rather annoying frequency. Well, this particular professor was schooled in many theories of art and color and shape, especially cubism. And he got an idea, and so he convinced his superiors to let him paint the guns in his battery using different drab, earthy colors and following a pattern idea based upon cubism. This is what this resulted in. And something happened really fast. All of a sudden, the Germans had a really hard time finding those French guns. And so this fellow was promoted, and he became the head of an entire section of the French army devoted to camouflage, developing camouflage paint patterns, physical camouflage in the forms of varieties of netting, and so forth. But it was, again, it's art, and the French were pioneers. And they had a variety of patterns. Now, the practical problem of our first tank, the Schneider CA-1, getting across no man's land. Remember, it's a tractor with all this extra metal weight added on. Well, here's the office. This is what the machine gunner station looks like on each side. You can see the big ball mount, solid piece of metal. Hotchkiss machine gun. He's got his work cut out for him. This is the front of the office. This is the driver's station. There's the howitzer right next to him. This is part of the motor. It's all open. Think about that. Imagine being placed inside a dumpster with a generator, a gas-powered generator, and somebody fires it up and then they close it. There you get the idea. The acoustics in there must have been were unbelievable. This gives you an idea of its size. It's not a big machine. And there's a crew. Five men are going to crowd into that thing. This is a training version with no body on running cross-country as they're developing familiarity. Notice the short track base. This is going to be a problem. It had another problem, a fatal design flaw in the first production series. The fuel tanks were in the front. So what would frequently happen is that if a shell came in the front, or if there was a penetration in the front, it would rupture the fuel cells. Now remember that motor in the middle, uncovered, just sitting there? Fuel sprays back in and right on that hot motor. The French called it, soldiers quickly dubbed this the mobile crematorium. This one blew apart because of just such a hit. The other problem, short track base, clumsy. Not very underpowered. This one attacked a German trench and fell on its side. So the combat debut was at Bar au Bac. And what happened at Bar au Bac, this was 1917, during the Nivelle Offensive. They committed 132, led by Commandant Louis Bossu. And they had told the infantry commanders, whose units they were supposed to support in the assault, that they needed to create channels across the French trench line so the tanks could cross all across the front and advance directly to the assault. Instead, these orders were not carried out across the board. So in many cases, the Schneiders would arrive, the approach during daylight to begin with, which was a mistake. They arrive and find that, well, there's no crossing point. So they have to turn right or left and proceed down the line until they do find one. This started causing the Schneiders to bunch up at a few actual crossing sites, and meanwhile, the German air spotters spot them. So German reconnaissance picks them up, turns around and alerts their artillery, and in comes the artillery, zeroing right in on the crossing points where the tanks are queuing up. And this is where they took a beating. Most of them were destroyed by, that the losses were inflicted by artillery. It was 50% of all the, of the 132 CA-1s committed, 50% were destroyed overwhelmingly by the artillery fire. It was a fiasco. It did not work. They quickly found that the Schneiders were vulnerable as sin to artillery for the reasons I've outlined. They were painfully slow. They had a lot of trouble getting across. This is a photo of, and before Berriot Bach, of Commandant Bossu and his personal tank, Trompe les Morts, literally defy death. Bossu was killed in action, leading his troops, and he would literally get out in combat. And during the First World War, many times tank commanders had to do this, unit commanders anyway, as they tried to negotiate the terrain. They would get out of the vehicle and direct the vehicle from outside. I mean, again, it's no faster than a walking man on a good day, and it's really hard to see out of these early tanks. The vision slots, by the way, they're just slits in the armor. There's no protective bulletproof glass or anything. There's no periscopes. It's just a slit, and you put your forehead up on that metal armor bulkhead, and you look with your eyes straight through that opening. This is, they quickly discovered their tanks were, the armor was too thin for what the Germans were throwing around, especially after the British used their tanks. The Germans introduced armor-piercing K-bullets to their machine gunners, so they could penetrate the first generation tanks with machine gun fire. So this is one of the reasons the French were very upset with the British for not waiting for them. So they had to up armor the surblindier, or literally extra armor, that they added to the front of the Schneiders. They created a package, if you will, of extra armor plating that they added. As you can see, while it stopped the K-bullets, it didn't stop artillery. German light artillery shot this one to ribbons, and you can see again, the roof is gone, the back end is blown out, and the sides here. Again, catastrophic fuel explosion. It just was not funny. So it really was futile courage. But again, courage nonetheless. I mean, there's all kinds of stupid jokes about French, you know, being chickens and their tanks have one gear forward and 10 in reverse and so on. It's utter rubbish. The courage of these men is really beyond question, and in both world wars. But that's another lecture. This is an example of a somewhat over-the-top surblindier or appliqué armor package. They've even added an extra shield around the howitzer in the hopes of trying to give themselves a slight edge and increase in survivability. So they start revising the design. One of the first things, of course, they're going to address those darn fuel tanks. But meanwhile, French politics being what it is, there's a rival design team that comes into the fore. They decide we're going to do a better tank. And so the fuel tanks get moved because enough's enough. In this case, the roof ruptured when the fuel cell blew. So this is the last surviving Schneider. It's now at the French École de Cavalerie in Saumur, France. It had sat at Aberdeen Proving Ground until just a few years back when they swapped it to the French Cavalry School. And they are tickled pink, obviously, to get it back because it is their very first tank, and this is the last one. This is a modified and updated definitive version of the Schneider. What I'm circling here is where the fuel tanks wound up, all the way in the back. They added extra armor plating, of course. They added some better ventilation, but fundamentally, it's still a Schneider. It's still a tractor with a box. And they also made a change in camouflage. One of the early problems they had is, I described how you look through a vision slot, it's just a slot. Well, the French tankers quickly complained that the Germans were shooting for the vision slots with their machine guns, and a lot of guys were getting injuries in the face and the eyes. So the French camouflage section came up with a very clever solution, which worked very well, it turned out, under battlefield conditions. They painted these crosshatch designs very strategically. It broke it up. Can anyone find the vision slot on the side of the tank? It's very well hidden. Even I'm having trouble recognizing it. Actually, it's right there, if I'm not mistaken. This is another thing. They're learning how to support and logistically support and operate tank units. So notice here, your first dedicated tank, specialty tank transporter. This picture is actually taken in the 1920s in Morocco. And this is a Spanish Schneider being used during the Rif War. Spain purchased their first tanks from France in order to try to put down the Rif Rebellion because they were getting, frankly, clobbered. But again, that's another tale. But as you can see here, a powerful, increasingly powerful tractor truck, a dedicated trailer for carrying a heavy tracked vehicle. The French are innovators. So here comes the rival. This is the Char Saint-Chamond, named after the arsenal where it's designed. The Saint-Chamond design team thinks, oh, you have a little howitzer. We're going to put a full-size 75mm gun in ours. You have two machine guns. We will have four, one on each side, one in back, and one up front. And we're going to do all kinds of fancy stuff with the innards on this thing, too. It's going to be bigger and badder and more powerful. So they get to work. But you could probably already detect some of the early problems with some of the fatal design flaw. And it's got a big one. And it's actually worse than it looks. Besides, this is why they put the gun in. This is an actual 75mm field gun, complete with its full-size trail and carriage. All they did was take off the wheels. And then they just bolted it in place. Notice the exposed engine. This is an actual little animation or stereoscopic image of a Saint-Chamond. So again, you had the more machines. You have one on each side, one in front, one in rear. This is being used for training, apparently. This was taken during a training exercise with U.S. troops. This is named Teddy. The French would name their tanks, much as the British did and later the Americans. This is the office fully crewed up inside of a Saint-Chamond. You can see the backs of two machine gun, the side machine gunners. You see the engine in the middle. There's the gunner. There's his gun. There's the driver. Again, everybody's clustered around an engine. Imagine trying to communicate, especially when you're firing your weapons. So it's bigger and better, right? Well, looks impressive. It's awfully big. Looks powerful. Scary. Look at the gun. It's a full-size French 75 rapid-fire field gun. So it can lay down, theoretically, lay down a curtain of fire up to 30 rounds a minute. You know, bigger is better, right? No. As one French military officer who observed the tank on trials declared after finding out how thoroughly underpowered the Saint-Chamond was, he said, "It is an elephant on the legs of a gazelle." The vehicle was driven by two 22-horsepower motors, electric motors. They had a gas-powered engine, which in turn drove two 22-horsepower electric motors, one for each track, to move this entire bulk. This, as you can see, is the other fatal flaw. This extensive overhang of the body over each end of the track base. In this case, this Saint-Chamond has come to grief trying to cross the railroad tracks. And he's literally got his gun stuck, it appears, under the track rail. He's not going anywhere for a while. This picture shows the severity of the overhang. They tried to solve it by putting these little rollers under the nose. Obviously, it didn't work. The other problem was that weak powertrain I mentioned. Well, what happened is when the old Saint-Chamond got stuck, especially crossing a trench, the driver would rev the engine trying to get out, and of course he'd wind up burning out the electric motors. You're not going anywhere. Well, May 5, 1917, the Saint-Chamond has its combat debut. It's a minor attack near the Lafaux Mill with two Schneider groups. The Saint-Chamond's problems immediately became apparent, especially its lack of mobility because it was so underpowered and overweight. And also just mechanical failures. These early tanks are temperamental. They break down. Early engine technology, this period, it's still evolving. It's still in a primitive state. So, you know, remember, this is where the time of the Model T Ford, where you crank the motor to start it up by hand. There were mixed successes. It was part of the Nivelle Offensive, which was a debacle. This was the final big offensive the French army pulled in the First World War, where they essentially went in whole hog, bayonets fixed, en avant everyone. The Nivelle Offensive, as I said, it was a disaster. It produced 120,000 casualties for a net gain of not much more than 300 meters. it resulted in mutinies. The French soldiers literally mutinied in the sense that they did it in a very French way. They didn't turn on their officers and kill them like the Russians did a year later. They simply refused to leave their trenches. And they got up and they left the trenches and went back, marched back out of the range of German artillery in order, kept their order, kept their weapons, and then camped and said, look, until we get certain reforms and better leadership, we're not going back there. It's not that we won't fight, we want to fight, but we're sick of just being thrown into the teeth of German artillery and machine guns as lambs to the slaughter. No more. We have terms, here they are, do something about it. In other words, they did. They went on strike. So, Neuville is sacked. Henri Pétain, who was considered the savior of Verdun, is promoted over him. And Pétain handles the problem of these mutinies, and we're talking entire divisions, essentially leaving their positions and stepping back and saying, no, hell no. Pétain handled it very gently, actually. He met with the elected leaders of the strike, if you will, the mutiny. He listened to their demands. He granted most of them. He ordered, and he said, okay, we will shoot a few ringleaders, or the bigger troublemakers, but fundamentally, we're not going to punish everybody. We're not going to decimate the ranks. We're going to give them what they want because they're actually right. So they got improved pay. When they were sent back for rest, they were actually sent back to rest, not just do manual labor, still in range of German artillery. The situation changed. But even so, the Nivelle offensive was the last draw for the fighting spirit of the French infantry. So Pétain, well, he realized the tank's potential. And he decided what we need are more tanks. And we need intensive training between the infantry and the tanks. So the next time that the Schneiders and Saint-Chamans go into combat, it's at Malmaison. That's October 23rd, 1917. There's 92 tanks involved. Now remember, they've been training. Pétain has intensified the training. 92 tanks. They only lost two. They gave the Germans a beating. And they showed what could be done. Now again, think of all the problems. And the French realized the limitations of the Schneider and Saint-Chamans. They are vulnerable to artillery. And so, among other things, they tried Band-Aid solutions. Let's improve the Saint-Chamans. We add this A-frame roof so when the Germans throw grenades or satchel charges, they roll off. Let's put a different gun in to make it easier to handle from inside a tank. Well, no. It didn't fundamentally change the basic problem, which was the tank was too darn long for the length of its track base and too underpowered. It was just too vulnerable. And again, you know, it's just too long for its own good. So what do we do with these fatally flawed designs? I mean, the Nivelle offensive, as I said, 120... Imagine, this is actually, this movie, The Paths of Glory, if memory serves correct, Kubrick read about the Nivelle offensive, and he drew... This is actually an incident from the Nivelle offensive. And again, the soldiers were just sent in across no man's land. I think to this day, this remains one of the most realistic movie renderings of what an infantry assault before the arrival of sufficient tanks, well, any tanks, looked like on the Western Front. Just futility. So the mutiny comes, and guess what? All of this is going on. They're thrashing around for solutions, and our friend Colonel Jean-Baptiste Estienne crosses paths with his acquaintance Louis Reynaud, the car maker. He was a big industrialist, and he's already well involved with building up, providing production for the war effort. He happens to cross paths in a hotel in Paris, and so they sit down to have dinner, hence my dinner with Louis. Well, talking back and forth, bouncing ideas, Estienne had an inspiration, the bee swarm tank. He decided that the problem is we're building too big a machine. We're overtaxing the French war industry, which is already straining at the breaking point. What if we made something smaller? We could make more of them. We could use sheer numbers to accomplish what a few big Galumphing Schneiders and Saint-Chamans are not pulling off. You're looking here at one of the few surviving prototype pre-production run FT-17s. It's distinctive because it has a single-piece cast turret. This was the original turret that they planned, and they discovered quickly that it could only accommodate the machine gun. It was not adaptable. It was very difficult to produce for the French industry at the time. So they looked at that, and they came up with a solution to simplify production. But this is essentially what got doodled on a napkin in a Paris hotel restaurant in a meeting between Louis Renault and STN. And Renault had learned about the tanks, but he didn't want anything to do with them because he looked at them and thought, oh, no. He could see where all the problems were. But this got his attention. STN's bad idea, he liked it. Remember, he's built motor cars. He understands things that are smaller in automotive. So, notice in this case, the turret is different. This is a production Giron turret. It's built up of rounded curved plates on a frame, and you can have a flat gun mantle, so you can put this stubby little cannon in there or the machine gun, depending on the job you want it to do. This is a top view looking down. Again, this is a French Renault. We know because the exhaust muffler is located on the right side of the vehicle, for starters. There are some other differences. We'll cover this later with these and the copies that we made here in the United States. This is the Omnibus turret made by Berliet. It's an eight-sided turret, flat plates, even easier to make. This is a common turret in use, more so actually than the Giron turret. This is a blow-apart view of what this little bitty guy did. Now remember, you had the Schneiders and Saint-Chamans lumbering around with five or six guys, sometimes seven guys crammed inside them. You got two men here. Very simple, very straightforward. And notice the configuration. You have a turret, fighting compartment up front, engine in the rear. This is the granddaddy of all modern tanks. The French invented this layout. This was their idea from the start. Jean-Baptiste Estienne is the grandfather of the modern tank. And again, remember, the French were aware of what the British are doing, but they're doing it their way. You know, vive la différence. In this case, you are seeing a five-vehicle platoon on training, and it consists of three cannon and two machine gun chars, the French color tank chars. The idea is, as it says, a swarm of bees. The idea was, these little felt, they could build five of these for a single Schneider or Saint-Chamond. And again, learning as they go. The early tanks are, they're temperamental. They're not mechanically all that robust. They break down a lot. There's quality control issues. There's simple limitations of the technology. So you can't have them just trundling around and all the way driving from factory to the front. No. You get trucks that are sturdy enough and powerful enough to physically load them and carry them and deliver them. See, again, this is a French innovation. The British are still moving their tanks. They half disassemble them, put them on flatbed rail cars, move them up as close as they can get them on the railroad, offload them, put the sponsons and other bits back on, and then let them drive all the way up. The French are ahead of the game. And, of course, the rail transport, the French were big on that. They had learned their hard lesson from the Franco-Prussian War when the Germans had used a superior railroad network to mobilize faster and more men and swamp the French. They're getting specialty versions as they go along. This is the TSF, which is the abbreviation essentially for a wireless telegraph system. In other words, Morse code radio. This has a two-way radio transmitter receiver. This is a battalion, a regimental command vehicle. These are support tanks. They were just coming into service near the end of the war. A fixed turret with a 75mm howitzer, the same one used in the Schneider, and they wanted to attach one of these for every section of Renault's to give them extra bunker-busting power. This is another view of it, the BS. It's a French abbreviation, essentially references the howitzer. They made small numbers of these, and they actually were turning up in early World War II. Learning the hard way, you know, the tanks have their limits. They are clumsy. They can get thrown off balance by irregularity in the terrain. So the French are learning as they go. But they are, and there are limitations, as you can see. It can't cross a wide trench or a super wide shell hole. The poor little guy will fall in. But they, and communications. Say hello to my friend Francois, the driver. I'm his commander. I'm in the turret. I'm running the gun. I'm looking around. How do I communicate with him? Because the engine's right behind us and there's no firewall. So the racket in there, can't hear myself think, and he sure as hell isn't going to hear me anything I tell him. I kick him in the back. I kick him on the left side to go left. I kick him on the right to go right. I kick him in other places, preferably not too hard, to get him to go forward, to stop, and so forth. That's communications. Oh, long-range communications, in this case, British style. Open hatch, send pigeon. Hope pigeon finds its way or doesn't get shot by some hungry German stormtroopers who now have squab for dinner. Small but stylish. It's a small tank. It's the granddaddy of the modern battle tank. And, of course, the French give it the full treatment of their other innovation in modern warfare, camouflage painting. There is a huge variation in French camouflage on armored vehicles in the First World War, from monotone greens to, as you see here, just every conceivable color, 3, 4, 5 colors at a time, sometimes 6. It just goes crazy. They also evolved tactical markings very quickly. They started this with the Schneider units. Because they follow the artillery organization of 4 batteries, they use playing card symbols to represent each of the batteries. So hearts, diamonds, spades, clubs. And, of course, this one is named Le Tigre, the tiger. And again, as you can see, wide variety of variants in camouflage, finishes, colors used, and so on. Ochres and blue-grays and grays, light grays, almost white, greens, black. I mean, they're just, it was really for anybody that likes to build model tanks or is a war gamer, the French armor of this period is just fun. You can get away with all kinds of craziness. This one has a great name, Billy the Clown. I mean, this is just too funny. Now, of course, 1918 comes up. The little Renaults are not quite there yet. And the Germans pull their last great offensive of the war, the Kaiserschlacht, literally the Kaiser's battle, their last bid to try to break through to Paris and win the war. And the reason is that the British naval blockade is doing its insidious work, and it's really now being felt in the German homeland in terms of huge food shortages, fuel shortages, shortages of every description. German home front morale is on the brink of collapse. The troops are in a bad way. They're getting by with ersatz anything and everything, from coffee substitutes to uniforms made from fabric that was forged out of or fabricated out of thistles. I'm not joking. Thistles. Preferably without the spines. But these are Stosstruppen. Notice the light kit. They're not weighed down by packs and such, but they're armed to the teeth. Hand grenades galore. All of them. That's their principal weapon. These bags you see over their shoulders, these are empty. These are sandbags that have been adapted to carry grenades. So they're bags full of grenades. That's their principal methodology of attack. A very quick artillery barrage, and they're right behind it. The barrage lists and out come the Stosstruppen practically in your face. And they're not shooting, they're throwing grenades. And it's devastating. So a crisis erupts. The Kaiserschlacht is aimed right at the weakest sector of the Allied line, which turns out to be the British front, right where it joins the French front. They rupture the British line. They are busting through and on the move. Paris is in danger. Paris is starting to evacuate. The first Renaults have to go into action, but they're not ready. They're still training. They're still working up. They haven't even had enough tanks delivered to train everybody. They have to evacuate the French training school to get them to get out of the way of the German offensive. Well, they get them out of there, and they quickly discover, the Allies quickly figure out that there's no real direction to the German offensive. They're just sort of going where they see the encounter the least resistance. And in fact, this is precisely what they were ordered to do. The supposed German military geniuses of Ludendorff and Hindenburg, they were completely obsessed with the idea of the offensive. Keep it going. It doesn't matter. Just keep it going. And when Ludendorff was asked by his staff, well, where are they going to? What's the objection? He screamed at them, it doesn't matter. They just need to keep going. So the French and British, the French command realized there's an opportunity here. We can massage this herd away from Paris if we aim the counterattacks in the right places. So, May 31st, 1918, Villers-Cotterets, it's only 45 miles northeast of Paris. They've managed to pull together a battalion of the 501st Tank Regiment. They deploy them in a woods outside of Villers-Cotterets, with the Germans near have infested the nearby Vertfeville farm complex. It's a very large farm complex in the area. So the forest is overlooking this farm complex. The Germans have moved, the Stoßtruppen have moved in, they're setting up strong points. Well, the local French commander realizes my infantry can't do it. If I go in with my infantry, they're going to get chopped. But I just got a battalion of these newfangled little tanks. So, and what do you know? They can fit between the trees in the forest. So he sends them threading their way through the forest. He's got a tank platoon threading its way through the forest, followed by French infantry, by French infantry company. The Germans have sent patrols into the woods. Now you can imagine the looks on their faces when they've bumped into this French counterattack. And who knows what they must have been shouting when they came running out of the woods with these things trundling after them. The tank platoons, the way they broke, the commander broke it down is, as I said, he put an infantry company with each platoon. There were only in the entire attack and combat, which was throughout, which raged throughout the complex, the French sustained two casualties. Two tank drivers were injured by bullet splinters. The Germans were essentially routed with heavy losses. Interestingly enough, Heinz Guderian was on the staff at the higher command structure went on the unit that was on the receiving end of this French attack, the first French use of the Renault FT-17. And he took a keen interest in the reports that came in. Of course, we'll hear about Guderian in 1940 in France. So, the Renault proves itself. These tanks were at, as I said, at the Vertfeville farm complex. It's also nearby was at Plessis-Chazelles. And again, they were a smashing success. As one German Stoßtruppenreiter remarked, he described the Reynos attacking his position as a weird rabble from rising. Like he said, they moved with the rapidity of weasels, like some weird rabble from hell. So I call them weasels from hell. And he said that basically they couldn't deal with them. There were too many. Even if they managed to disable one, the others just swamped them. So, enter the Americans. Remember, this is the 1918, this is the period of crisis. We have declared war the previous year, but we're trying to get our act together. We don't have anything beyond rifles and a lot of enthusiasm. So we come with our Springfield rifles and our American issue uniforms and our Montana hats. We have to get steel helmets from the British. And we have to get our machine guns and automatic rifles from the French because we're still a little bit sore at the British for that thing in 1812 for burning the White House. And we don't have any tanks. We have no airplanes. So we go to the Allies we trust. So we go to the French. The French give us their newest and best tank, the FT-17. So we form our own tank battalions, being taught by the French, French methods, etc., French equipment. And we are, of course, asked to do something to plug the line, because this darn German offensive, while they're managing to divert it away from Paris, it's not happening fast enough. They need the British and French really, really, really need help. So finally, we get put in the line. Now, where the tanks come in is on September 12, 1918. The 344th and the 345th Tank Battalions received their first combat experience in Saint-Mihiel. And, of course, that's really where the German offensive, the Kaiserschlacht, is blunted. But the real trial by... And they quit themselves very well. That's where, by the way, a very important K is going to get his experience there. I'm getting a little ahead of myself here. I'll back up just a second here. This is about the lessons learned. This is a supply carrier version of the Saint-Chamond. The French figured out early on that the tanks would need supply under battlefield conditions from time to time. So they modified a number of Saint-Chamonds into supply carriers, probably a more useful role for them. Those problem with bullet splinters, this is their solution, an armored face mask. So a mix of hardened leather, metal louvers covering the eyes, and chainmail for the lower face. And wonky as it is, it pretty much worked. So, Americans, we go in. Our first experience with tanks was actually with French tanks supporting our doughboys at Catigny, and they were Schneiders, believe it or not. And the result was a resounding success. The painting shows in a rather wonky fashion, but the French aircraft were also present. French Air Force provided interdictive support, strafing and bombing German positions, no German positions, as supporting the American attack. And we followed the Schneiders in into the town to run the Germans out of Catigny. And according to the American accounts, the French tankers were gutsy. Once they got in the streets, several of them would literally dismount, as you see in the painting, riding, hanging on the back there, using the armored fuel cells as cover, and use carbines to plink Germans hiding and trying to fight from the houses. So Catigny was a resounding success. The French also supplied assault troops using flamethrowers to back up the Americans. So between them, they cleaned house. But this is the fellow I was mentioning. Meet George, Colonel George S. Patton, Jr., later general. His first experience as a battlefield tank commander was in the Great War in an FT-17, commanding a units of FT-17s. And that would be in the Argonne, in the Meuse-Argonne offensive, which was the real trial by combat for the American tank arm. And that was September 26th through November 1st of 1918. Our tank units were supported by three French tank battalions. Patton was in command, and it was there that he was wounded in the leg after his tank had been shot out from under him. He rounded up a bunch of American tankers whose own tanks had been shot up or disabled, and using the armed only with their 45 caliber pistols, he led them in an infantry attack where he was promptly wounded in the leg badly and had to be carried off the field. Patton was true to character. So again, Soissons, all the tanks are being committed. The French are using the Schneiders, they're using the Saint-Chamonds, they're using the FTs together. So again, if you're a model builder, or especially if you're a war gamer, if you do certain actions of 1918, you can have all three on the table in their garish camouflage. Malmaison, as I mentioned, again, the French Schneiders in action, the Saint-Chamonds. The French tank arm at this point, the artillery d'assault as it's known, or assault artillery, they've come into their own. They've matured. They understand the limitations of their machines. They understand what they can and cannot do. And then they proceed to do what they can do and increasingly well. Yes, once a Saint-Chamond, always a Schneider. The design is our dead ends. And the French realize it. They realize that these are dead ends, but they'll have to do until more Reynos can come on board. This, of course, is the immediate German solution to the problem of the tank. They built, they designed this weapon, the Tankerwehr, model 18. It's a 13 millimeter single shot bolt action rifle. Imagine the recoil on that thing. And this is one that's been captured by U.S. troops. It, as you can see, it's ridiculous. It's a gigantic bolt-action rifle. But it fired a 13-millimeter cap bullet that could penetrate most of the tanks of the day. The Reno, however, benefited from the hard knocks of the Schneiders and Saint-Chamonds. So the Reno had 22 millimeters of frontal armor, which is about twice what the Schneiders and the Saint-Chamonds had, as a direct reaction to the K-bullets and this little monster. This is another example of the French uniforms. This is how they've evolved. This is how they would appear in 1917-18. This is the French tank arm, the Horizon Blue uniform. They've now added a leather jacket, protective black leather jacket. They wear a beret, which is a distinctive elite troop headgear for French soldiers. It's usually only seen by groups of chasseurs alpines, but the French artillery d'assault have earned the beret. Then they have the Adrian helmet, and they modify it by shortening the brim so it's easier to wear the helmet and look through that slot in the armor to see where you're going or who's shooting at you. As you can see here, we have all three flavors. The principal flavors of the Reno, the Char Canon with the 37 millimeter trench gun. Oh, by the way, it fired not just a high explosive round, it had a beehive round, that is to say, a grape shot round. So if Stosstruppen tried to rush you and put a bundle grenade on you, you had a means of retaliating. Essentially, it turns the weapon into a 37 millimeter shotgun. Mm-hmm. This is the TSF I mentioned earlier, the radio telegraph vehicle. Many problems because it's not voice radio, it's Morse tap radio. With all the problems that goes with it, it's early technology, but hey, it's the first of its kind. It's a dedicated C-cubed armored vehicle. Here's the machine gun variant. So you have the three main flavors of Reno FT-17. The end of the war, the FT-17 has been built in its thousands. It will remain in service into World War II. Our paratroopers and our GIs, and during the D-Day operations, encountered a number of FT-17s in German service being used as airfield security vehicles. They also were used for anti-partisan duty in the Balkans. The French, of course, committed hundreds of them in 1940 to try to stop the German invasion. They also turned up in armies around the world in the interwar period, every point from South and Central America to China. Yes, even a Chinese warlord had Reno FT-17s. The most recent finds were in Afghanistan, where several were recovered, where they'd been used as a roadblock by the Taliban. So this is probably the grandfather of all modern tanks, and since most tanks have followed this configuration of turret forward, engine to the rear, since the Reno, and probably will for the foreseeable future. And it's like a cockroach. It turns up everywhere during the interwar period. But that is the tale of the French tank arm of the Great War. And I thank you all.
Leland is also going to be the next speaker. We'll go ahead and do questions now about the French tank arm.
Absolutely.
And then we'll have a break. I need caffeine. I see other guys in here also needing caffeine for the next thing. Leland is going to talk about kit bashing, which includes science fiction as well as historical stuff.
Oh, yeah.
But it includes some of the things that are involved with how they made the tanks. Leland said this quite well. They were all underpowered until they got to the FT-17, which fortunately the lower horsepower engines were able to move. Only two guys in there and not as much equipment, not as much armor. That was a very... We forget because this was at the end of World War One. By the time of World War II, we had much different tanks and so forth. But this was a very, very successful design. I believe 3,000 of these.
Yes, over 3,000.
It was incredible. We look at the British land ship, that giant, you know, lozenge-shaped, treaded monster. That didn't last beyond World War One. It just didn't go anywhere. They used a few of them in Russia and a few other places, but this one kept working because it was designed by a car designer, Renault, and he did a fantastic job. And it is, like Leland said, the grandfather of, when you look at that, modern tanks look like this. Obviously, a little more modern, but the turret that can rotate 360, the protective engine and the gas tank in the back, right? Not in the front. And then, the treads overlap the body, and not the reverse way, which you saw in those giant ones, which were just unbalanced and couldn't even cross a railroad track without digging into the dirt. Leland, this was fantastic. Thank you very much.
You.
I really like the nice touch of the... It's very artistic.
A font, and I saw it when I was choosing it from PowerPoint. I instantly thought of the old black and white silent movies,
yes,
and the newsreels from the period.
Yeah, exactly.
And of course, the early French filmmakers of the day.
Very
and I thought,
yes,
I thought this is perfect.
Well, I like the fact that you brought in the camouflage thing too, because that was huge. I mean, a lot of us don't know about. And you're waving because we've got what's.
Yes, because is that the official introduction of camouflage? Is that what is
pattern camouflage paint was a French invention. In fact, if you give me a second, I'll give you the fellow's name. He was an academic artist, and he was he literally cooked it up, the use of pattern paint.
You mentioned Cubism. Cubism was huge at this time. We think of it as modern art.
I'm plugging
also employing the dazzle paint.
Correct. Correct.
On the Navy ships.
Yeah, his name is Giron de Scaevola. He's an academic painter.
Can you spell that real quick?
Giron, his first name is Giurand, then Day, D-E, and then capital S-C-E-V-O-L-A.
One more time, last name.
Yeah, De Scaevola. Smaller D-E, then capital S-C-E-V-O-L-A.
Okay.
Yeah. Sounds Italian.
Yeah, Italian. Yeah, it's Italian, but he's a Frenchman, apparently. So probably... Probably
that's
one of those. Probably the French render. Because the first name Gérand. He says he was an academic painter who was serving in the artillery near Metz, early in the war, and he was well versed in artistic theories about human visual perception, especially cubism, and persuaded his unit's officers to let him try disguising the unit's gun batteries. The effort was so successful that on February 12, 1915, the Ministry of War established the Section Camouflage under De Scaevola, which set about recruiting artists and craftsmen to assist in camouflage efforts. Although these efforts largely involved the development of camouflage nets and other forms of camouflage material, De Scaevola and other artists came up with elaborate schemes in camouflage paint artillery to break up the gun's distinctive shapes. The patterns were dubbed zebrage, better known as dazzle painting in Britain. First applied to artillery and later to tanks, the camouflage was intended to confuse the viewer regarding the actual shape and details of the object more than to blend it into the background. The early camouflage schemes tended to be quite intricate and fussy, involving multiple paint colors, which required considerable skill to apply. By late 1917, this gave way to simpler patterns that could be applied by minimally skilled workers in factories or depots. Studies conducted by the Air Force in 1917 led to the abandonment of the pre-war artillery gray color, as it was found to be too evident on aerial photographs. The preferred color was a dull, dark green-brown, the precursor of the olive drab and olive green shades so widely used ever since on tanks. That's reading from what I consider the best primer on the subject of French tanks of World War I that has come into print in my lifetime. This is French Tanks of World War I by Stephen Zaloga.
Yeah, Steve Zaloga is a very famous armor expert.
Oh,
the title is French Tanks of World War I. It's an Osprey book. Okay.
It's fantastic primer.
Zaloga is he is Mr. Armor.
Yeah, I think he's got tank in his DNA, personally.
One of the great artists who did all this cubism and was involved with camouflage was Picasso. And just to let you know, Leland, because I want you involved in this, because we're going to need models. What we're doing is, my daughter works for a big architectural firm that has a very close relationship with the Museum of Modern Art. If you are a member of this organization that she works for, you can just walk into MoMA for free because they give them that much money, okay? The reason this is important is because I'm convincing my daughter to let me talk to the people at her company to talk to MoMA to do a World War I display with these kinds of art. Ships, tanks, using camouflage and how it came into a practical military use rather than, you know, just art on a wall, okay? And we're trying to work on getting a display, an exhibition at MoMA. Yes, Anne?
I have another follow-up question.
Anyway, we're working on that as something to do for the centennial.
Well, then they definitely need to know about Discovola.
Yeah. And well, some of them may know about it, but they may not know about all these applications. Because we want to have little model ships with these dazzle camouflages. We want to have these tanks and everything. Go ahead, Anne.
My follow-up question is, I'm finding it remarkable that the French arrived for the artillery in the tank.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I'm thinking the other services came through the cavalry. Am I getting confused?
Actually, yes. You are. Here's the thing to understand about the French. The artillery has been there, was their battle winner up until the First World War. The artillery was regarded as the absolute king of battles. Napoleon Bonaparte was an artilleryman. The success in battle on the Napoleonic battlefield many times, if not most times, seem to hinge on the artillery and its best use over your opponent. Who got the most guns in the right place at the right time? It was the artillery that would dominate. As artillery became breech loading and quick firing, it really began to dominate. And in fact, it was in the Franco-Prussian War that the Prussian artillery absolutely dominated the French, because the French were still using muzzle loaders. The Prussians had introduced steel breech-loading guns. So their rate of fire was almost exponential. It really took the French... It was a rude surprise. But the French always had a powerful psychological attachment to the power of artillery. Now, you come at it with another dimension, which is the technical element. The fact that French artillery is where the industry is focused, because the idea of a tank, this hasn't gelled in the minds of anybody except maybe before the First World War, H.G. Wells, who wrote a sci-fi story called The Land Ships before the First World War broke out. But again, in the vast majority of minds, especially military minds, you have three arms. You have the infantry, the cavalry, and the artillery. And it is the artillery that can dominate. It's the artillery that has made fortifications, if not obsolete, then extremely vulnerable. It is the artillery that you arm your forts with to make them powerful. It is artillery, cannons, that make warships powerful, forces to be reckoned with. It is artillery, cannons, that have made the dreadnought battleships of this era the WMDs of their day, and some both the most powerful weapon system then in existence on the planet, and the hallmark of a great power. So the mindset, there were, as I tell my students, I teach a military history course for a private school, when you look at the past, when you try to understand the world or the thinking that was going on in people's minds, their world was not our world. Their perception was not our perception. Their knowledge was not our knowledge. They did not see things as we did. Their experiences, their collective experience was not ours. So the idea of a tank was something completely radical. But as far as who's technical is concerned, it's the more technically oriented arm that would be likely to come up with this. Now in England, the leading technical arm is the Royal Navy. And guess who the big drivers were behind the land ships? It was the Royal Navy.
Yeah.
It was because Winston Churchill was a very ambitious politician, and he was first sea lord.
Yeah.
And so the idea of land ships, and what did they call the first British tanks? They gave them names, and in front of each of the names, whimsical or serious, was HMLAS, His Majesty's, HMLS, His Majesty's Land Ship.
You know, you said something at the very beginning. I think there was a problem that they were looking at. And the problem was this. Infantry would go forward, and even if it broke through an area, outran its artillery. They had no heavy artillery to could go and stay up with the infantry. And that's what was going to support them and be able to allow them to maintain control. So the problem, as you said, was how do you get the artillery
forward
with these guys? So that was the problem. They're sitting there, and therefore the artillery of the guys were trying to figure out how to do that. The solution was, let's put the artillery pieces inside a box that is bulletproof. And we use whatever we've got. The tractor is available.
Well, they had the tractor.
Right.
They were using the tractor to pull heavy guns and over rough terrain. And they thought, okay, well, the tractor can pull it. But then they're thinking, well, wait a minute. The problem is the tractor is extremely vulnerable to shrapnel, to from artillery fire, and to machine gun fire, trying to cross no man's land. So, as you said, they got the ideas serendipitously. It starts to come together, and people get this inspiration. And it's Jean-Baptiste Estienne who gets the inspiration. If we can encase it in an armored shell and put it right on the tractor, we have assault artillery. Les artillery d'assault.
But it's the artillery guys who are the ones who are going to come up with this, because it's their problem.
Right.
How do we get our guns up there? Whereas the cavalry has a different problem. It's how do we stay relevant?
And that's what would come later with the particularly in France, leading into World War II, is that the cavalry would finally begin to trade in their horses for fast armored fighting vehicles. They started with armored cars, and then they began to transition into tanks.
Yeah.
And that's why in World War II, when war breaks out, the French army actually has two separate tank arms. You have the infantry tanks, which are the divisions Crossiers de Reserve, and you have the divisions La Guerre Mécanique, which are cavalry divisions.
Right.
And so they are two separate tank design philosophies operating, two different roles. The DLMs are actually going to perform the role of horse cavalry, which is to scout, to do armed reconnaissance ahead of the main body, and to screen the deployment of the main army bodies behind them. And that's exactly how they operated then, but again, that's another lecture.
But it is interesting, motorization coming.
Coming
into World War I like this, and it's interesting that the French did this. Oh, what time is it? Close here?